Senate Judiciary and Public Safety Committee will come to order. For the record, the date is January 27th, 2011. Members, we have a brief agenda today. Judicial Standards Board and the State Guardian Ad Litem Board will be giving a little review of what they do and why. And we're going to begin with the Judicial Standards Board. Mr. David Paul, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator. Members of the committee.
Mr. Paul, we've been having difficulty with our microphones lately, so if you could pull that close, that would help for record keeping.
Thank you.
How's that?
I think that's fine. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator.
Afternoon.
Ladies and gentlemen of the committee, the Board on Judicial Standards exists to process complaints which allege that judges and judicial officers, such as referees, child support magistrates, etc., comply with a certain code of personal conduct. And this code of personal conduct is to be distinguished from the role of the judicial officer or the judge in the decisional context, when a judge or a judicial officer is acting to make a decision, a ruling on evidence, a final order. This is, if there are mistakes made, of course, every day in this regard, but these errors, if they are errors, are determined by the Court of Appeals and the court system, the Supreme Court, not by our board. Our board strictly processes complaints alleging personal conduct, such as ex parte communications, conflicts of interest, demeanor issues, this type of thing. We are and have been since our inception a two-person office. There's never been any increase in personnel, although despite the fact that in the last 10 years the volume of work at the agency has doubled from about, actually more than doubled. It's gone from about 645 total contacts a year, or just total volume a year, the first year I started, which was 1998, and now it's around, but usually every year it's between 1,550 and 1,600 total contacts. Our two basic responsibilities are, first, what I call education in the most general sense. What this really is dealing with judges, lawyers, and the general public as to what we do and what we don't do. It's a very important aspect of our work. People call from all over. Many of them have decisions that they are dissatisfied with. It's my job to explain to them where they should be to contest those decisions and what types of things we could consider for them. This last year, I think we had about 1,200 or 1,300 calls of this type from both the public and lawyers. And then we have every year between 200 and 350 calls from judges. These are specialty calls asking for advice on various issues of ethical behavior that arise, and we try to give the advice promptly and the best we can. The code is extremely broadly worded. It's worded in a way which is inclusive of standards as opposed to exclusive. And it can make it a little unwieldy at times to interpret, but we try to do our best. There are many, many cases that have come up over the years, and I try to use those when I'm giving my advice to judges. The other aspect of our duties, which is, oh, by the way, with regard to education, I do go out and speak regularly to various groups, not only groups of judges, but groups of lawyers, groups groups that belong to the general public, such as universities, that type of thing. The other thing we do, which is, of course, much more difficult and not nearly as much, is that we the board recommends discipline on occasion for judges who have, who they feel have violated the code. And we also provide a process for judges to contest those decisions by the board. And that process is set out in detail in the rules which govern the board on judicial standards. And fortunately or unfortunately, I guess we've had some publicity of late with some fairly high-profile cases. Normally, we do about one of these a year. This year, it's going to be many more because of what I consider to be a kind of anomalistic result over 2008-2009, where we had five or six cases that appeared to be going for hearing, and that is still the case. I should point out that the board is never in control of that aspect of its activities. The board does its best to determine if any discipline is necessary, and if so, what that discipline should be. But it is a proposal, and it's subject to challenge. It can be challenged before a panel appointed by the Supreme Court. We've had several of those in the past few weeks. And then the Supreme Court, if anybody appeals it, which is usually the case, the Supreme Court does make the final decision, and it takes the cases without any pre-assumptions. Just takes the case fresh from the transcript. It's free to decide whether or not the facts have been found correctly without any kind of standards, and what code section should apply, and what discipline is appropriate. We have in our jurisdiction now over 550 judges and judicial officers. We're right around 400 judges and referees and magistrates, and there are a number of part-time magistrates and referees that are under our control. The administrative law judges do their own in consultation with us, and the tax court, even though it's an executive court and not a judicial branch court, is part of our jurisdiction. By agreement. We have a website also, which usually gets about between 19 and 20,000 hits a year, and that seems to be fairly stable. I'd be happy to take your questions. We have two basic requests this year. We're asking that we be restored $14,000 per annum. That was taken away last year in the budget crisis. It just seems that no matter what we do, we're kind of in the process of getting deficiency requests in, and it just seems likely that the best thing to do would give us a little more to begin with, perhaps. Our budget is $888,000 for 2 years. That's $440,000 for 1 year. Each year includes a revolving fund, which we use for attorney's fees and investigations, formal investigations. That is $125,000 per year. So it's actually $440,000 with minus $125,000, which is what we use to operate in the $125,000. Plus, we have about a $25,000 budget item within our board, which also helps us to investigate cases. And I should point out that we never had a revolving fund there's been two other executive secretaries before myself. All of them have tried. I was finally successful in getting it 2 years ago. And the reason is that with this revolving fund, we have some money, and we don't have to rely on lawyers to hire investigators for us. Lawyers, as you know, can wait for their money, and they did, but of course they would always charge us more. They would charge us their standard fees for investigations. And this has been a tremendous money saver for us because we've been able to hire them directly, which is the main reason that the prior legislature was convinced that this was the right thing to do. So that explains the $125,000 per year for that. I just want to make a general statement that we have all these judges in the state. The vast, vast majority of them never have a problem. Many of them call, 250 to 350 a year call, but that doesn't mean they're having an actual behavior problem. They just want to know how to handle a specific situation. And it's these hearings that we have had lately are kind of unusual and atypical. And we feel that this too shall pass, and we'll be getting back to our normal one hearing a year fairly soon. With that, I'd be happy to take any questions that the committee might have.
Thank you, Mr. Paul. Are there any questions? Yes, Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Paul, nice to see you again. I got three questions. I think they're very, very brief questions. Number one, does the board have jurisdiction over the justices on the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court?
Mr. Paul.
Yes, we do have that jurisdiction with several very minor exceptions. I don't think we have jurisdiction over the Supreme Court with respect to the what we call the 90-day rule, which is the statute passed by this body that requires all decisions on motions and final decisions be delivered within 90 days of the date of submission, which is a term of art meaning the date that everything is in for the decision. And I don't think that we have the jurisdiction on that particular point with the Supreme Court, but we do have jurisdiction over the Court of Appeals and Supreme Court justices.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Newman.
But in the event of misconduct on the part of a Supreme Court justice, and I most certainly am not alluding that there has been any, I'm just saying in the event that there was misconduct on the part of a Supreme Court justice, does your committee have jurisdiction or your board have jurisdiction to investigate that?
Mr. Paul.
Mr. Chairman. Yes, we do. In the final analysis, though, when a Supreme Court, and I don't think it hasn't happened, it's very, very rare, of course, but it has happened that Supreme Court justices have run afoul of the Code of Judicial Conduct. And what happens is that there's a switch. Other justices from the Court of Appeals are appointed to judge. The Supreme Court judges don't really judge themselves. They appoint from the Court of Appeals. And so that kind of is an important factor. It's a very rare situation, of course.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My second question. As I recall, there are certain areas that involve the work that the board does that is considered confidential, i.e. not open to public scrutiny. Could you outline for us a little bit what the board considers confidential and is not subject to examination by the public?
Mr. Paul.
Senator Newman, yeah, I'd be happy to do that. The board works a great deal on a private level, by private I mean non-public, and it does some of its best work in this way. It keeps all complaints confidential unless and until the board determines that a formal complaint should be filed in a given case. Then it's filed in the Supreme Court and becomes public for everybody to see. But the majority of the board's work is at a confidential level. When I investigate cases, for the evaluation, I always tell whoever I'm talking to, a member of the public, a lawyer, whoever I'm trying to find information on about a case, that this is a confidential conversation. And I truly mean that. The board wants to hear from people who have no regard for the decision. They want only to hear about, they want the people to focus on the personal conduct. And to do that, you have to tell them, first of all, that there's no way that you can affect the decision. If they won at the lower level, they'll keep on winning. And unfortunately, if they lost at the lower level, they'll keep on losing. But this has nothing to do with that, that this is something very special and something very unique, that we need their candid opinion on the personal conduct of the judge, for example, on a demeanor issue. So that goes for everybody. And I often tell them that, the only way that they're going to be, it's going to be determined that they talk to us is if the case does become public. But even then, I don't disclose what they tell me. I just send our lawyers in their direction, and they do it from the beginning. So It's a very important item of our work, the confidentiality. The board keeps all confidential, all the complaints confidential, and it has a variety of discipline that it can impose on a confidential level. And usually, Senator, this is usually enough. It's very rare that anything that there's ever a repeat of improper behavior. The confidential private discipline is usually enough. Yeah, and I might say that, for example, there is the private admonition that we can do. There's a letter of caution. There's a deferred prosecution. It's not really a prosecution, but it's kind of a prosecution that we can do from on a private confidential level.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My final question, Mr. Paul. I'm looking at the disciplinary case expenditures, and I know down at the bottom, and I was totally unaware of this, it says total includes attorney's fees for judges' counsel. Does the state of Minnesota provide attorneys and pay for those attorneys in disciplinary cases involving judges? And if so, at what stage does the state provide the judge with an attorney?
Mr. Paul.
Senator Newman, the board does not pay for counsels retained by lawyers retained by judges and judicial officers, with one exception. And that exception is when the judge claims there is a mental disability, or the judge claims or there is an issue over mental disability. At that point, when it becomes clear that the board is investigating a mental disability problem, at that point we are under the rules obligated to pay the judges or judicial officers' attorney's fees. That is the only time that happens. The reason that is in there this time, on none of those cases did this occur except for two, the Ginsburg case, which I believe is listed in there, and another case which we just finished with. Those are the only two disability claims we've had in the last 8 years.
Thank you, Mr. Paul. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any other questions? Mr. Paul, the question I had is, now you're the administrative office of the board. How are the members of the board selected? Who are the members?
Mr. Chairman, the members are made up of four judges, one of whom is a judge from the Court of Appeals, four members of the public, and then two lawyers. So it's four judges, four public members, two lawyers.
All right. And do you have any explanation of why from 1999 to 2010 the number of contacts or accusations, if you will, have grown to over nearly 250% in that time period?
I really don't. I've made an effort to reach out toward the public by giving presentations, and I've made a specific effort to reach out to the judges and judicial officers, some of whom often view the board initially with some trepidation, and they're a little reluctant to contact the board. And I've tried very hard to address that. Whether that's a part of it or not, I really can't say. It increased steadily for about 6 or 7 years, and then it just kind of leveled off. But at the same time that it was leveling off, we started to get this website data, and it became clear that many of the people were going to the website. So I really don't know exactly if that is responsible, but it might be an answer to the question. Okay.
Mr. Paul, with that increase in contacts, is that affecting your budget?
Mr. Chairman, it really does not affect our budget in the sense that we have to have telephones anyway, we have to have equipment anyway, there's only the two of us. So I don't think it affects our budget. What it affects is the time that we have to spend on other matters, which is a difficult problem, but something that we just have to work through. There's just a lot more calls than there used to be.
Mr. Paul and members, it seems like with this growing number of contacts, at least it's been my experience in my office, I'm getting more correspondence that's telling me people are having a difficulty with some judges. And I thought it was just kind of a blip on the radar screen and it went away, but it seems to be coming more of a pattern that I'm noticing. And maybe it's because, and it's not just because for the past month and a half I'm now the chairman of the Judiciary Committee. I was ranking member of the Judiciary Committee for 6 years. And I've been on a Judiciary Committee for 22 years. And in the first half of that time period, I would never hear about a complaint about a judge. But I think it's been about the last 8 years. There seems to be a constant, although low, but a constant number of contacts a year that citizens who may not feel that a judge treated them correctly, followed canons, or just was plain belligerent with them. Now, granted, it may be a difficult job, and I want to at least recognize the difficulty that some judges may have, but the public, at least the ones that are in that category or class of complainant, they're asking us to do something about it. And I'm trying to determine if the legislature has some type of a standing with separation of powers, or if it does or does not. Or do we just leave it with the judicial branch to correct their own? But it seems like it's a growing problem, and it certainly has a greater frequency. There's no question about it. And do you have any suggestions on what would help us help the judicial branch?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I suggest, first of all, that as many of those people as you can be referred to our office. You know, I know how to deal with them. I deal with many a day. And I can usually talk to them and convince them as to what they have to do on the decisional part, and some of them are, I get very valid, what appears to be very valid complaints. Some of them are not valid, but I always try to explain to them how they can process that and what they should do. And I think also that in terms of what the legislature could do at this point, I think the legislature has done everything that it can do and what it needs to do, and that is, of course, there was the separation of powers question in 1973 when the board was about to be created, and this was solved with the constitutional amendment, and the legislature authorized the Supreme Court to make the rules. It kept for itself the budgetary issues. It gave to the executive the power to appoint people, all of whom are confirmed by this body, with the exception of the judges, because of the separation of powers issue. But I think, this agency is a very independent agency, but it is very much a creature of legislative invention. And I think that this is where it's the only agency that does anything about this, or that has any official duties to do anything about this problem. And I agree with you that it's increasing. I think that you and I had a talk a few weeks ago, and we were discussing whether or not the economy and the hard times increased this type of activity. And I think we agreed that we thought that was a good possibility. But whatever the reason is, I think that we're heading in the right direction. And I think we can certainly handle whatever comes from the legislature. We would encourage that you do that.
Mr. Paul, you made mention of who the members would be in this combination. Who appoints the members of that board?
The members, Mr. Chairman, are all appointed by the governor.
All right.
And like I said, they're all confirmed by the Senate. You'll likely see two of them come up sometime this year, probably later in the spring when the governor catches up.
So, Mr. Paul, those are staggered terms.
Yes, they are. They all come up about two persons for every 2 years.
So. Right. Okay. Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Paul.
Yep.
Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize to members. I was a little bit late. The constituents show up, and my constituents are always first. So I spend time with them whenever they do show up. And so I wasn't here for this, but I guess a couple things. You know, having been to court a number of times as a business owner and not really even aware of this whole process of judicial standards, I'm just going to tell you one thing that happened to me and then I guess go through if that fits a judicial standard type of thing or and then to move on as to how do people know about this kind of thing and how do they know to report it, because I didn't think of anything back then. I wasn't in the legislature. But I had a case where I was a defendant, and the judge looks at me with a straight face and says, I find no basis in law, and I'm quoting, I find no basis in law, although I feel as though the plaintiff has been aggrieved. I was dumbfounded. How do you answer a judge that is there to enforce the law, and the first words out of her mouth were, I find no basis in law? I mean, those kind of people, there should be little black men, in my opinion, that come out of the back room at that point and pull them away and get them off the bench. They don't deserve to be there. I'm irate, and I'll be bringing some legislation forward on some of those kinds of issues. But does that fit what we're talking about here in terms of judicial standards? And the second thing is, how do people find out? How do we disseminate that information when people have those complaints? Because I really didn't understand this whole process. I've been looking into it because of legislation I'm working on now to get people to know that you exist.
Ms. Paul?
Mr. Chairman, this is exactly the type of question that I get 15 to 20 times a day. And so I'm very glad to be able to handle it from here, because I think it might be of interest. You know, when a judge says to you that I find no basis in law to give you what you want, although I feel that you have been aggrieved or hurt by whatever circumstances has happened, what the judge is telling you is that, you know, you may have been certainly hurt by this, and it may not have been justified, but I can't give you the relief that you request because I don't find in the law the authority to do it, which, of course, judges, like everyone else, have limited powers, and, of course, the main limitation is to apply the law. If you were calling me, Senator, and putting that exact question to me, I would say to you that it's not the kind of thing that our board has power over, because it involves the judge acting in his or her decisional capacity. In other words, the capacity to make rulings. And that is something that certainly can be challenged, but it cannot be challenged at our board. It has to go to the Court of Appeals.
Okay, Mr. Chair?
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you. And what this judge did, I was the defendant. They did find in favor of the plaintiff after saying they found no basis in law, but they felt the plaintiff had been aggrieved. So they found in favor of the plaintiff even though they found no basis in law.
Well, that
Mr. Paul.
Mr. Chairman, that could be an error. And I hope that if you felt that it was an error, that you considered moving that up to another level, because that's the only way that can be corrected. And it works well, believe me. But it's not something that can be challenged. For example, we couldn't tell this judge, if you had filed a complaint with us, judge, you cannot make a decision like that because it's improper. Because it's not improper from a personal standpoint, although it may be improper from a legal standpoint.
Mm-hmm. Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess that's troubling even to find that out, if somebody can actually make a decision and there is no way that they find no basis in law, and we have no remedy other than to go ahead. And in this case, the decision was for a much lesser amount than it would have taken to bring it to the next court. And I think somehow the court finds it that way because they know it would be extremely hurtful to try to spend the money to exact justice at that point, or to find a judge that would enforce the law as opposed to enforcing their feelings. So that's the kind of complaints I get, members, from people, is things like that where judges aren't applying the law, and it sounds as though we may have to create something new in order to actually force judges to apply the law and work within their oath of office. Because when they say they find no basis in law and still exact a judgment, they are in direct violation of their own oath of office, and there needs to be a remedy to get rid of them at that point.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to address myself, Senator, to your second question, which was, how do we get the word out about the board? And the way we do it is we maintain a website that has about 19,000 hits per year, and we We also have a brochure that we send to everybody who calls us, everybody who will give me their address. And I also try to get out into the communities and meet with people and try to let them know who we are, what we do, what we don't do.
Mr. Paul, if do you know the website address off the top of your head? I know I'm putting you on the spot.
I know that if you Google Minnesota right. Board on Judicial Standards, it'll be the first thing that pops
right.
up.
Just in case someone's paying attention out there.
If my assistant was here, she could tell you.
All right. Thank you. Senator Lapp.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll just note that probably everyone who goes up to the Court of Appeals believes that the district court judge had no basis in law to make their decision whether the district court judge said so on the record or not. It's exactly what the appellate system is designed to deal with. It is an issue in terms of use of resources. It's not cheap or free to go to the Court of Appeals. The filing fees to get into district court have gone up, and they don't even go to fund the judiciary. They go to the general fund. There was a tax increase on everyone who files as a civil filing fee. And filing fees for the Court of Appeals similarly. And then, of course, there's a question if you want to have a lawyer. If you're a corporation, you've got to have a lawyer. You can't appear in court, or you act as your own lawyer if you have an individual case. The price of justice is something we all need to be cognizant of, too, as we consider, you know, fees and everything else relating to the judiciary. But there's some things it's kind of hard to get around. It's the time that's involved or the expertise that's involved, to proceed within the legal system.
Mr. Chairman, I might point out that our Rule 4C is the rule that says that we have no part in disciplining any judge for making findings of fact or conclusions of law. And the last sentence of that rule is that claims of error must be made to the appellate system. So we are very strictly controlled in that regard.
Well, thank you, Mr. Paul. Oh, Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that point, Mr. Paul, thank you for the report. But you make findings on ethical violations. That's a fair statement, is it not, with regards to
Paul.
Judges?
We don't make formal findings. This calls into issue the way the board used to be under an old version of the rules and what it is now. Now we don't really make findings. We make decisions, and those decisions are either accepted by the judge or judicial officer, or a panel or a Supreme Court panel is requested and appointed, and the panel is the first entity now to make the findings and conclusions of law, which again can be appealed either by the board or by the judge who has been.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator,
just finish with a comment that I had in my previous life, where I actually was involved with a judge, that there were some allegations, some ethical allegations against him. And it had nothing to do with the ruling. It was just an ethical violation of something that he was doing with his own private life, helping somebody else, and it was deemed to be unethical, or at least it was investigated as unethical. And I had a good experience with that. The office came out and actually did something with that violation, and I think it turned out very well. So I know that it's a tough job to do that, and it's a tough job for me to pursue it as well. However, when you're elected to positions, you have the authority to do that. But it was a great outcome, and I think the folks were served very well on that, and the judge I think found out that he or she is not above the law when it comes to some of those ethical things, and so it was just a good experience.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I just wanted to comment. I assume that was a private type of disciplinary procedure, which is what the board really does extremely well.
Mr. Paul, we did find your webpage. www.bjs, B as in board, J as in judicial, S as in standards, bjs.state.mn, .us. And thank you for addressing our committee today. We thank you.
You're very welcome.
The next on our agenda is the State Guardian Ad Litem Board, Suzanne Allegro. And I hope I pronounced that correctly.
Allegro, close enough.
Allegro. Thank you for attending. You're welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Suzanne Allegro, and I'm the program administrator for the newly created State Guardian Ad Litem Board. And what I'd like to do is talk a little bit about the State Guardian Ad Litem Board, the legislation that created the board last session, and some of the work that the Guardian Ad Litems do. The purpose of our board is to administer a statewide guardian ad litem program to advocate for the best interests of children, minor parents, and incompetent adults in juvenile and family proceedings. The mission, the common mission of both the board and the individual guardians is to provide quality representation for abused and neglected children. The board was created, as I mentioned, as part of legislation last session, and the program was moved out of the court system and put under the control of an independent guardian ad litem board. There was no new money appropriated as part of that transfer, but basically whatever amount was being spent on the program in the court system was transferred to the new guardian ad litem board. The reason this was done was over the years there had been concerns about the guardian ad litem program being administered under the court system when there were concerns about conflicts of interest or the appearance of a conflict of interest in the courts housing a program that provided support and supervision to individuals who are party to certain proceedings that the court presided over. Over the years, the Minnesota Guardian Ad Litem Program has undergone significant, almost continuous change in probably the last 15 years. This started in 1995 with a legislative audit report where the legislative auditor was looking into complaints from citizens about the Guardian Ad Litem Program. At that time, the programs were administered in the individual counties, so there were there was no consistency regarding recruitment, selection, supervision, training, complaint processing. So in response to that, the Supreme Court set up an advisory committee to address the issues that the legislative auditor had proposed. In 1999, in response to the legislative auditor's concerns, the Supreme Court promulgated rules of guardian ad litem procedure, which stipulated standards for recruitment, selection, training, complaint processing, and oversight. In 2001, the courts began to look at whether, at the whole issue of whether the guardian ad litem program should be one of those programs moved over to state funding. And that did happen in 2002, and that gave a little bit more structure to the program that it now became state-supervised and judicial district-administered. In 2003, there were revisions to the Minnesota Rules of Guardian Ad Litem Procedure, and also in 2005, a quality assurance review procedure was implemented. In 2007 and 8, the Supreme Court did set up another Guardian Ad Litem Advisory Committee, and this was basically to examine the long-term challenges facing the program and make recommendations. And the two major recommendations were, the first one was to move the program out of the court system and place it under the independent board. The other major recommendation, at the time the programs were operating, they had a combination of, in Hennepin and Ramsey, for example, it was volunteers, paid staff, and contractors. In most of the other judicial districts, the programs were a combination of employees and contractors. There were some supervision issues with the contractor system, so the decision was made to go with employee and volunteer programs. And the contractors were A number of them were made employees. This was done, the conversion from the contractors to employees was done July 1st of 2010, and again, that was done within existing budgets.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Lance.
On that question, point, Ms. Allegro, did that include part-time employees as well as full-time, or did everyone go full-time?
No,
Ms. Allegro.
Mr. Chair, Senator, we still have, no, if they were part-time, some of the employees were converted to full-time, but we have, especially in the outstate area, 0.2 FTE, we have 0.4 FTE. So it was basically the conversions, they were converted to employees, but it was based on need in that particular district, so they were not all converted to full-time.
Thank you.
All right. Please proceed.
Per the legislation, the way the board is set up is the board is established as part of the judicial branch. However, the board is not subject to the control of the judiciary. And the board consists of 7 members. 3 of them are appointed by the Supreme Court and 4 by the governor. The chair is appointed by the Supreme Court from one of the governor's appointees. And then my position is hired by the board. The board was appointed in October of this year, and then I began work January 10th. On page 6 and 7 of your handout, I do have a listing of the current the board members and a little bit of their background. The legislation did set out requirements for board membership, including that no active judge could be a part of the board, and you know, that the attorneys and the public would need previous guardian ad litem experience. There are 4 mandated duties that the board has, and they are to approve and recommend to you a budget for both the board and the program, to establish procedures for distribution of the funding, and this is basically, obviously most of this is based on caseload, to establish standards, administrative policies, and policies, procedures, and rules, and to appoint a program administrator. In addition, there are 3 permissive duties: to adopt standards, policies, or procedures necessary to ensure quality advocacy for best interests of children, to propose statutory changes to the legislature and rules to the Supreme Court, and to appoint an advisory committee. I'd next like to talk a little bit about the work of the individual guardians, and the program is operating under both federal and state mandates. In 1974, Congress enacted the Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act, and in order for a state to receive federal funds, the state must enact and enforce laws mandating the appointment of a guardian ad litem on every juvenile court case alleging that a child has been abused or neglected. The following year, the Minnesota legislature enacted guardian ad litem statutes. And in the juvenile area, the law indicates that the court shall appoint a guardian ad litem to protect minors in any proceeding alleging a child is in need of protective services. And in the family court area, the court must appoint a guardian ad litem where custody or parenting time is an issue, and the court has reason to believe that the minor child is a victim of domestic abuse or neglect. In response to the auditor's report, the legislature prescribed 5 primary duties of a guardian ad litem. One is to conduct an independent investigation, and this is basically to determine relative facts, to interview the child, the parents, teachers, and also to observe the child in the home setting. Another mandated duty is to advocate for the child's best interest, and this could include appropriate community service, to maintain confidentiality, and this except where sharing of information is permitted by law, to ensure cooperation, monitor best interests of the child throughout the proceedings, and to present written reports that include conclusions and recommendations and the facts upon which they are based. Just a few brief facts about the program. We do have a $24 million 2-year budget. Around the state, there are 649 guardians ad litem, 210 are employees, and 449 volunteers. Our volunteers, as I indicated previously, are in Hennepin and Ramsey and also in the 1st Judicial District. We are able to provide 100% coverage on mandated cases. Prior to state funding of the Guardian Ad Litem program, we were only able to provide 55% coverage on mandated cases. Regarding our caseload, in 2009, a little over 15,000 children were served on over 12,000 cases. This compares in 2003 to around 7,000 cases for 10,000 children. The current structure is there are 10 distinct programs, one in each judicial district. And just a few challenges facing the board. Obviously, the board, we want to ensure that we maintain 100% compliance with federal and state mandates for guardian ad litem appointments. The board also wants to ensure that the mandated duties, according to the statute, are carried out. Also, we're looking at studying the delivery of guardian ad litem services on a statewide basis and to make recommendations to ensure that the duties are carried out in the most effective and efficient manner. For example, we are looking at sharing of resources across programs, better coordination of training, and also to design and implement an administrative structure and policies and procedures. And then last, our budget request would basically be to the only new funding we're asking for beyond our current base is to cover unavoidable personnel costs that may occur with increased health insurance and statutorily mandated increases to pensions.
Thank you, Ms. Allegro. What would the dollar amount be on those personal costs?
For the biennium, be $329,000.
You said they're personnel costs. What could you?
No, those would include insurance increases and PERA costs.
Any other questions at this time, Senator Engelbretson?
Yes, thank you, Ms. Allegro. Going back to page 10, there's a comment on there's a. Under the federal mandate heading of your presentation to receive federal foster care funds, are we still involved in that? Can you take me through that a little bit?
It's my understanding, Mr. Chair and Senator, we're getting a little under $500,000 from the federal government.
And a follow-up.
Department of Human Services.
Okay, Senator Ingerbritzen.
So that's where it's funneled through, is Department of Human Services. And how has that been over the past bienniums, or is that something new now? It says they've been funding since 74. Do you have a little history on that? Has that been going up or down?
Ms. Allegro.
Mr. Chair, Senator, my understanding it's remained fairly constant, but I will, I don't have the history on that, but I will get that to you.
Thank you.
Senator Newman.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Allegro, page 13 or slide 13 indicates that 210 employees, 449 volunteers. Of the 210 employees, could you give me an idea as to how many of those are administrative staff, how many are actually individuals who would act as guardians ad litem?
Ms. Allegro?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I will say we have 11 program managers. One in each of the judicial districts, except for the 2nd Judicial District, or the 4th Judicial District, where we have two. Those would be considered administrative. We also have, which I will get you the exact number, program coordinators in a number of the districts. And then the rest would be actual guardian ad litems. We do, though, with the administrative staff, they do carry, most of them, if not all, carry a caseload as well as performing administrative duties.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Allegro. I notice between fiscal year 12 and fiscal year 13, the insurance cost goes up over four times. Can you explain what's going on there?
Mr. Chair, Senator, these are the figures. We got from the These are projected figures, and it's my understanding that these are not firm, that they have to, this is something that would be negotiated with the employees, but these are the projections we receive.
Attorney General Bauer.
Well, Mr. Chair, Ms. Allegro, I think as we look at budget issues, we ought to figure out what would drive that kind of an increase and get some firm numbers, because that's a major cost increase that we ought to be checking on and making sure what's the driver there.
Ms. Allegro.
Mr. Chair, Senator, this would be something that would be negotiated with the unions, mm-hmm. and we would just follow along. If there were insurance increases, we would these would be the costs that our agency would have to absorb, but it's nothing that the individual agency has any control over.
Chair Jenbar.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Allegro, I guess I'm really troubled then, because it looks like we just told the union where our negotiating range might be. If this is something that's negotiated under union contract, so it's extremely troubling at that point.
Ms. Allegro, any comment? Ms. Allegro, I might have a question in the same regard. Help me understand this. When the legislature budgets for an item like insurance, what comes first? The collective bargaining negotiations that's between the administration of this agency and the union? Or is it done within the limits of what we may set as a budget?
Mr. Chair, I'm maybe not the best person to answer that. It's my understanding they would put out some parameters that they're going to use in order to negotiate, that the individual agencies and departments, you know, typically don't get involved in that. We just, you know, would put those parameters in our budget. And then once there is an agreement with the union as to if there's going to be any increases to the insurance costs, then the agency would have more definite figures. So this cost probably is not going to go up, but I assume it may go down depending on how the negotiations go. But the individual agencies do not get involved in that.
Any other questions? Senator Jungbauer?
Well, Mr. Chair and members, I guess then it appears to be exactly what I just said. If it's projected and somebody gave parameters, then we just pre-negotiated or gave the union what our projection and parameters are, and that's no different than putting in an automatic escalator, and we ought not to be even considering that. As many know, the unions do drive a lot of what goes on in terms of our cost of doing business in the state, and that's I'll be working on a number of bills that way, members, because we got to get away from that. We can't keep doing business the same way without going broke and bankrupt as a state and our counties and cities as well.
Thank you, Senator. Ms. Allegro, I was told that this figure may be an estimate from the MMB office,
right. Yeah.
And that's why it's in the paperwork. Mm-hmm. And so, if we had any further questions, I would imagine we'd have to ask them why they came up with such a wide range. Senator Newman first. Senator Newman?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Going back to the page 13 again, Ms. Allegro, there's 449 volunteers that are listed, and I know that in the past I have dealt with guardian ad litems who, they're not employees. They are people that are in the community that are interested in getting involved and trying to protect children and vulnerable adults. And so I'm just wondering, in lieu of having a number of employees and in lieu of having an increase in your budget of $329,000 plus the $24 million that's there, could we be just as well served by going back into the community and asking for volunteers and independent contractors rather than employees?
Ms. Allegro.
Mr. Chair, Senator, regarding the volunteer programs, I think a number of the districts are interested in expanding the volunteer pool. However, in some of the outstate areas, it's a little you don't have enough of a population perhaps to draw from, so it only can be done in some of the larger cities. Regarding the contractors versus employees. I think the decision, again, as I indicated, that was done without any additional money, and I think they feel now that they are able to provide the coverage that is needed because they have adjusted the number of full-time employees to the need. So I don't know if going back to contractors would be a cheap. I wouldn't think it would be a cheaper alternative.
Senator Letts.
Mr. Chairman, just to Senator Jungbauer's point, I think unless we plan to recalibrate the collective bargaining agreement calendar, the starting and expiration dates for those agreements, separate those from the fiscal years for the state, or decide that we are going to plan to meet as a legislature after we've already set a budget in the fall, after collective bargaining agreements are concluded, and redo the budget that to account for whatever the conclusions are, then I think we're kind of stuck, as is every governing body is, when they've got these kind of issues. We're stuck dealing with projections and doing the best that we can in that regard. And we are a public entity, so I don't think we have the option of keeping everything secret like a private employer might have.
Senator Letts and members, Mr. Turner wanted to weigh in on this discussion.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Do you have any comment about this?
Mr. Chairman, members, I agree with what Senator Letts just said. This is current law projections on health insurance and para contributions. It has nothing to do with salary increases or step increases. And this is an MMB projection, and they project 7.7 increase on February 1st, 2012, and a 16.2 increase on January 1st, 2013. But to go back to the original question of Senator Jungbauer, we don't know why there's a 9% increase from 7 to 16. I think that was your original question. But this is a current law projection that's made by MMB, and it will be a line that will show up in every agency with state employees.
Okay. Senator Jungbauer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and I appreciate that. That really gets back to the point that we need to know what those projections are made on and whether they're valid or not, because our budget is driven by a lot of these projections and automatic escalators that we don't know, and we need to get a handle on it. And in some cases, if we knew what the projections were based on, we can control some of the outcomes or some of those increases by knowing what the projections are based on. This is my ninth year here, and we just don't get that kind of information. And when the budget's this far out of control, we need every bit of that kind of information to make informed decisions.
Any other questions? Ms. Legro, I had a question. On the State Guardian Ad Litem Board, now I've been, according to your notes here on page 5, it's established in the judicial branch. That's correct. And then the next line says, but the board is not subject to administrative control of the judiciary. So who is the board subject to?
Mr. Chair, it's an independent board that I assume like other, the appointment process that they are appointed by either the Supreme Court or the governor, but they are not subject to the control of the judiciary.
Okay. And could you tell me again the membership on the board, the title or position, not of individuals, but are there categories of membership that are required on the board?
Mr. Chair, basically they've asked, there's certain members that they would like to be attorneys, certain members public, and those, both the attorneys and the public, would need guardian ad litem experience. As I indicated, there is a requirement that no active judge serve on the board. So, but they've not basically said there need to be this amount of or that amount, that they basically have set out general requirements, and then it's up to either the governor or the Supreme Court to fill the positions.
Ms. Legro, is there a requirement that an active guardian ad litem serve on the board?
Mr. Chair, no.
Do you know why that is? I know we had a discussion about that a year or two ago in the legislature. I don't know where it ended up. It may have even passed out of the Senate, but it didn't become law. And I don't recall the logic of why you wouldn't have a practicing professional on a board that is supposed to be knowledgeable and give recommendations to those practitioners. And it perplexes me why we don't have that. But almost every other licensing board has someone that's a practitioner that's recognized and on the board. And I was just wondering, this seems like a fairly important service to the public, and I'm just kind of curious why that would not be required. Do you have anything to expand on that?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. I was not involved in the – I was with the Sentencing Guidelines Commission at the time and wasn't following this legislation.
Any other questions? Hearing none, thank you, Ms. Allegro. And members, starting Tuesday, my favorite subject. I know you can hardly wait. We're going to frolic through data practices. And we're going to have a little background of why data practices is so important for the privacy protection of our citizens, and at the same time trying to satisfy the public service and create that balance point. I will assure you it'll be an interesting discussion. And there's no and on Thursday we will be beginning to hear bills. Seeing no further action before the committee is adjourned.